New Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline is engineered with 4 levels of defense against gunk, wear, corrosion, and friction. It's sort of like having ninjas protect your engine. That helps keep your engine running like new. New Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline. It's fuel for thought in engines that continuously use Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcast, we greatly appreciate it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's about that time every week where we do interviews. And joining us now, he is the director of Quiet Storm, the Ron Artest story. You can check that out on Showtime. I believe they have it on the app, be playing on the channel. His name is Johnny Sweet. And Johnny, first thing, I saw the film. I thought that it was great. And just briefly, like, what made you want to tell Ron Artest's story?
Thanks for having me on. First of all, this is great. I wanted to tell Ron's story because, to me, obviously I'm a little biased here, he's the most important basketball story of the last 20 years. So, yeah, that's why I went for it.
Now, why do you think it's the most important of the last 20 years?
I mean, look, everyone can obviously debate. You can say LeBron, Kobe, et cetera. To me, in terms of ripple effects that were caused that helped, change certain ways we view, mental health in society. If Ron doesn't, say those words to Doris Burke after he hits, the shot in 2010, I don't think we are at this point in terms of societal discussion when it comes to mental health. So that's why I feel he's the most important last 20 years.
Now, you are from New York, right?
Yeah. I grew up on the Upper West Side.
Okay, yeah, because I live here now, and New York was more of an idea to me than anything else before I got here. And then once getting here, one thing I find interesting about New York that people don't talk about a lot is everywhere you go is the projects, right? Like Upper West Side, 68th at West End, we got a project right here. Everywhere you go, but the one that kind of dominates is the largest housing project in North America, which is Queensbridge, which I feel like is kind of a secondary character in the movie. It's almost like Baltimore is to The Wire. Like, is that a fair characterization?
No, I think it's very fair, and I feel like Queensbridge throughout the film had a symbolic value.
And so, like, for you as a person from New York, especially in that time, because especially with rap, like, I knew about Queensbridge, and I wasn't from here. I didn't realize it was a project. I figured it was just a neighborhood. So, like, living here, like, what is the thought process or the way that people see that part of town?
Well, when I was growing up, that was just one of the neighborhoods my mom said, don't go to. So, that's how I viewed Queensbridge until I was about, 12, 13 years old. And then when Illmatic came out, Queensbridge, as a symbol, basically changed, within that year because of that album alone. And then all the creative MCs that came out of that area, and also in Queens as a whole, as a borough, totally changed how, we viewed that borough. As someone who, grew up in the public school system in New York, but I was in Manhattan, so I didn't live in Queens, and it totally changed how we viewed the borough.
One thing I remember, I think it was when Nas' second album came out, he did some of the MTV, and he was talking about Queensbridge, and they showed it, and he was just like, look, right there is Manhattan, and it was so physically close, but I could not grasp the idea that it was far away until I lived here and realized how easy you can get, like, trapped into 5 blocks. But, like, that to me is like a crazy idea that, it's just sitting right there, and Manhattan's just right over there, you can just go over the bridge, except not quite.
Yeah, and guys will go up on the rooftops in Queensbridge and say, the city's right there in terms of, like, they see Manhattan, the skyline, this views of success right across the way, basically. And, but they're living in such different circumstances, yet they're so close. It was an interesting dichotomy.
Now, how would you describe the relationship between Ron and Queensbridge?
I would say Ron's the prince of Queensbridge. If he goes back, he knows everybody, and like, he knows everyone's names, family members, old friends. He stops by and, talks with everybody, and he just, Like, I think because he did a thing with the Today Show when he was promoting the film, and you know he stayed there, afterwards, just talking to everybody that came out, and you know he was like, you know, he's like everyone's favorite neighborhood, you know, person basically every time he comes back. So I would say he's like the prince.
It almost seems like there's a kind of irony that that giant man seemed like, at least from what I could tell there, like he seemed like everybody's little brother.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Ron's very approachable, you know, like he's guileless. He's sweet, you know, so I can see why he established so many, you know, long lasting relationships from where he came from.
Now, what was it like for you as the filmmaker being there and like doing the research and getting the shots and all of those things? Because one thing housing projects don't typically enjoy is outsiders.
Well, so here's the thing. When we filmed in Queensbridge, they were great. And I think it's mainly because there's been so much filming going on there the last 20 years in terms of, you know, music videos. And then like Roxanne Shanté had that movie there, done on her by Netflix. So I think they were used to camera crews there, and you know, people would come up and ask like, "Hey, what are you doing?" We're saying, "Oh, we're doing, you know, this is, you know, we're doing this on Ron." And they're like, "Oh, it's on Ron, Ron? Oh, okay, yeah, all right. I got stories on Ron, Ron." So actually, we were fine. They welcomed us with open arms.
Yeah, I think another interesting part about that too is, I mean, Ron Artest left Queensbridge in 1997, right? It's like we're talking 22 years later, and he still has that cachet with people who are there now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, his father was a big presence there as well. He has an emotional connection there, and I totally get it. And people that are attached to him as well, and you know, when he comes back, they view him as, you know, as Ron, you know, from Queensbridge. I don't think they view him as like, you know, this untouchable star. So, you know, it's nice to see.
Now, he's also a product of an era where especially high school basketball, like the idea of being a New York basketball player, I felt like meant more than it does right now. So how aware were you of him when he was in high school and playing AAU with Elton Brand and Lamar Odom and stuff like that?
I saw Ron play in high school. I had one of my good friends growing up. I remember when I was younger, he wanted me to come see LaSalle play because he wanted to see God Shamgar play. And like Shamgar was just like the talk of our area because Harlem was like, you know, 20 blocks away. So you hear tricklings coming down when people are talking. And we wanted to go, you know, he told me, "You guys see the Shamgar guy play." And when I went down, for me, my attention was drawn more to Ron because Ron was impacting the game, you know, on both ends in a dominant fashion. So that's when I first saw Ron as a high school player. And then obviously, like, if you you grew up in New York, you watched a lot of MSG, and Mike Quick had the had this high school show where he showed highlights, you know, of the best games and players every week. So I knew about Ron, I knew about Lamar Odom. I knew about Sham, so I was pretty well aware.
Were those guys like stars at that point?
Lamar was huge. Lamar was really, really, really big. He was definitely a star in the city. Sham was pretty big. Ron was big, but Ron was like the guy that we were like, we want him to stay. We want him to go to St. John's. Like that was how we felt about Ron. If that makes any sense.
Did he talk much with you about like the decision to go to St. John's, or was it even a decision for the guy from Queens to go to the school in Queens?
He was debating between St. John's and Miami, and you know he picked St. John's because he wanted to win in New York. He was very New York centric at that time.
I'm really surprised. You telling me a guy from New York in the 90s was New York centric?
I mean, that's what he told us, so I got to report what he said.
No, that's actually my favorite thing about you guys. Like, and now that I get here, I understand it completely. Like, the idea that New York, everything in the world that happens is New York. Like, I'm almost shocked that he even considered Miami, because New York can be so encompassing of your whole life to where you don't think about anything outside of it.
Well, Ron told us, I hope I'm not reporting this inaccurately. If I am, my apologies, Ron. Ron told us he was debating between St. John's and Miami because of, you know, an architecture program. So, and then, you know, but he was leaning heavily towards St. John's the whole time anyway, just because, you know, he wanted to play at the Garden and all that.
What was it like for you? You talked to Mike Jarvis, who was the coach of St. John's when Ron was there. What was it like for you talking to him? Because, I mean, of course, Artest is probably the best player that he ever had. And also, like, I remember watching those games where it'd be like, uh-oh, it's about to get bad here.
Well, yeah, well, we interviewed him with Tom Friend, who was the writer on this. He was with ESPN for a long time. Great reporter and writer. We interviewed him with Tom, and Mike was very open about Ron and Ron's, you know, what it was like to coach someone at that time. It was very, very revealing. And I remember when we reached out to him, he was like, I was hoping someday someone would knock on my door if a film on Ron was ever done, because there's important things I think that we need, you know, to talk about. And we were like, okay, yeah, that's why we're reaching out.
What did he think was most important for you to know?
I think from Mike's standpoint, what we got was that Ron was courageous in opening up about the things that affected him, the condition that he was living with, and he felt that that needed to be a story as widely told as possible because he felt that that would help people.
Did he tell you how long it took for him to recognize that there was something going on there?
He recognized immediately, just because so there's just so many fights in practice. So he recognized immediately that there was something.
So what I think is interesting there is that he recognized it immediately, but it sounds like nobody told him first, right? Like, I figure somebody else knew, too, that you would have talked to in the process.
We didn't interview Fran Fraschilla, who was Ron's first coach, so we didn't get the Mike was pretty adamant saying that, you know, Fran recruited Ron, and that was, you know, Ron was Fran's guy. But he didn't mention any conversations that, you know, him and, you know, the previous coaching staff, you know, about Ron's condition.
Yeah, one thing I noticed about the parts with St. John's is I feel like I knew Ron Artest was good in college, but I didn't remember just how good he was until I was watching those clips. Because, you know, he had this perimeter game, but he's so big and strong, it almost looked awkward at points where I was like, okay, maybe I don't understand what's going on here. And then I went back and watched the stuff that you had in the film, and I was like, oh, man, I was asleep.
Well, you know, that's the thing. He's a two-way player. You know, he dominated both. And as he got, you know, as he got older at St. John's, his, you know, his offensive game expanded. Is he the flashiest guy? Yeah, no. But the thing with Ron was he was fundamentally perfect. So that's what made he was kind of like the most New York un-New York player, because <you know? laughs> he was so fundamentally sound and played the game the right way all the time. And, you know, you weren't going to get your, you know, flashy cockback dunks and screams and stuff like that. He just, that wasn't him at that time. So, yeah, I mean, and, they, you know, they took, you know, he took St. John, he took down Maryland when Steve Francis was there in the tournament. Like, you know, they had big wins. They went to the Elite Eight. They were a strong team.
What was the vibe around New York with St. John's was like that? Because I feel like that's like the last really good to great St. John's team that we had.
It was the last time they were relevant in New York, not just because of Ron, but also because of Eric Barkley. So they were must-see TV in New York at the time. And, you know, that was tough at the time too, to break in there. Cause you know, at the time the Knicks were actually, you know, relevant. So, yeah, you know, they were closely followed by the city.
Yeah. Cause that is also like a Big East that doesn't exist anymore. Right.
Oh man, I miss the Big East so much. I went to Syracuse, so like I just miss those. I miss those physical games. I'm going through withdrawal.
But also, I think the Big East was, for me at least, it seems like the first like truly urban college basketball conference. Like, this was about cities. St. John's was the team for New York. Villanova was the team for Philadelphia. Like, this was the Eastern Seaboard League in that way. And I guess if you're out front for St. John's at that point, you're kind of out front for New York.
Yeah, I mean, they were the city's team at that point, and now I feel like it's become New York City actually has now become Syracuse's city in a strange way. It's really odd, you know.
Yeah, because it's far, like it's not close yeah. at all to here in any way whatsoever. It is not close.
No. I spent 4 years in Syracuse. It's like the North Pole.
Now, I want to get late, you know, later get a little bit more into like the mental health element of it. But I really did think that the timeline of this was so interesting, including Ron going to Chicago. And we all knew the detail of him applying for a job at Circuit City. I didn't realize he actually took it. I thought he just applied.
No, he was working there and, you know, he wanted to hang out with his friends. That's why he wanted to make sure when he had free time, when he wasn't practicing, that he wasn't out doing anything stupid. So that's why he went there. He wanted to hang out with his friends.
We also love Elton Brand saying, and we were coming to get the discount.
Hey, man, Elton told the truth. What are you going to do?
Like, I'm just saying, like,
wouldn't you do that if your friend worked at Circuit City, your Best Buy?
Well, that was what the best part was, because those dudes graduated from high school the same year that I did. And I remember, like, I know all these people now who do all these things and then get me all these dinner reservations and stuff, but I don't have anybody anymore that can give me 50% off electronics. But I had that in college, right? Because your boys work at whatever it is, everybody gets the discount. And that's why I laughed so hard when I saw that, because I was like, oh, yeah, that was me in that same exact age.
Yeah, man, you got to take advantage of retail, whether it's electronics, clothing, you know, whether it's even if they work at Starbucks, you can get half off on a latte, or why not? Like, you know, isn't that one of the perks of loyalty, of friendship?
Oh, that's exactly it. It's just Rod Artest working in the back. Like, imagine your first day at Circuit City, or you've been working at Circuit City, and you walk in, and it's like, yo, this dude that looked just like Ron Artest was over here breaking down boxes with me.
Yeah, hey, how can I help you? I'm like, well, I'm looking up at a 6'7" figure here. This can't be, is it? But I don't think he was on the floor. I think he worked in the back, just like stocking stuff.
In doing the movie, like, was there any point of, like, on that one in particular, I imagine I would have to look at Ron Artest and be like, well, dude, you really got a job at Circuit City? And I could just imagine him looking back at me with the straightest face, like, yeah, why not?
We actually didn't talk to Ron about the Circuit City. We had 4 hours with him, and so there are certain topics that we really wanted to like get into. So we actually did not ask him about that, but it was definitely in the back of our head.
And then from there, he gets to Indianapolis, and that, I thought, for the film was maybe the most fascinating part, as you kind of chart the rise of those Pacers teams while also Ron is having trouble holding things together. The thing was slamming down the HD cameras, and that was a very, like, this is like a real job thing, because they took $125,000 out of his check to pay for these cameras that he had destroyed. But then it leads us into, of course, which is such a turning point with him, the brawl in Detroit. But the thing I didn't realize until you mentioned it was, A, he and Jermaine O'Neal did not get along at all, and B, I don't think it really dawned on me up until that point that Steven Jackson didn't even know him that well either.
No. Yeah, well, Steven Jackson was only there, only played with Ron for those first 8 games that season. So, I mean, he knew of Ron, and he wanted to play with Ron because Ron and him, you know, had similar games, and he felt they could mesh. But yeah, the tension with Jermaine was real, and you know, it was legit.
Where did that start from?
I mean, you think about it this way, like Jermaine and Ron are like 1A and 1B of a team that you can make the argument should have won 2 titles. So if Jermaine is the captain of a team that is championship, that's bound for, you know, for a championship, and you don't make it, and one of the reasons you don't make it is because, you know, someone self-destructs the team, and it's the 1B person. I can understand how that's tough for the captain of the team to swallow.
Now, did Jermaine talk about any apprehension that he had about the fact that, okay, this dude has created another thing that's happening, and now, fine, I guess we're all fighting. Okay, I'm going to fight too.
In the moment, Jermaine wanted to protect his teammates as the captain of the team. So that was, in the moment, that's what he was thinking. Afterwards, he was upset with Ron. He approached him in the locker room. So there's that anecdote that's discussed in the film. But I think at the time, I think he felt he had to go into protective mode and stand with his teammates with this incident that was, you know, that they were dealing with in real time.
Before you talked to Jermaine, were you expecting to get the interview that you did? Because I guess I was surprised, not just with how forthright he was, but also, you know, again, not knowing what the backstory was. It was very interesting for me to hear him talk about it, because it seems like all of this still hurts him 15 years later.
I was shocked. I have to give 1,000% credit to Colleen Dominguez, who was a reporter at ESPN for 10 years. We got that because of Colleen, and Jermaine was very forthright and open with us. And you know, we didn't know a lot about these. I knew there were like little snippets just based on you know, media availability sound that was out there, especially during the early part of the season that led up to the brawl, because Ron had created a stir. He wanted to take time off to promote the Allure R&B album that he was the executive producer of. So I knew there was some stuff there beforehand, but I didn't know it was this entrenched.
Was it an easy interview to do with him on that? Did it require, like, pulling some of these things out of him? Or was Jermaine just like, no, I would love to tell you how tired I was of Ron Artest?
He felt it was time to talk about Ron. And I think he felt it was time because at the same time, they had also just patched up their differences. And, you know, Ron has always felt this sense of guilt towards Jermaine and the Pacers. And, you know, he just wants to develop a stronger rapport with him now, kind of like to make up for lost time.
Now, how did it feel for Jermaine? I know he talked about it a little in the movie, but from your, you know, conversations with him, after the Lakers won that championship and Ron says, you know, I bailed all my guys in Indiana, it was interesting to hear that Jermaine didn't take a lot of solace in that one. It wasn't like, wow, thanks for our acknowledgement. It seemed to be more like, yeah, you're damn right you messed it up for us.
Yeah, and I thought he presented a point of view that a lot of us would actually want to say in that real, you know, in that moment. You know, he could have taken the cliche route and said, nah, you know, all's forgiven, you know, everything's fine. But no, I think it was great that he told us how he felt, you know, in real time at that moment. Because look, if I'm busting my ass with my teammates trying to win a title, and I'm, you know, one of the leaders of this team, and I'm killing myself every year training, trying to get better, and, you know, we have a chance at reaching the ultimate goal, which is, you know, to raise the Larry O'Brien trophy, and we don't get there because of these, you know, these situations. And then you see that situation go and win a title with the Lakers. Yeah, I would feel, I could see, you know, the human reaction would be like, no, right now, like, it still feels raw to me. No, I don't feel happy for you right now at this point in time in 2010. I totally understood where he was coming from.
Steven Jackson, like, again, I had forgotten that he'd only been on that team for about eight games at that time. And I know we talked to him on HQ a few years ago about this. And he said something to us that he said in the film, that get in the locker room and Ron Artest looks at everybody and says, you think we're going to get in trouble? And that remains the most incredible thing I think I've ever heard a human being say before.
Yeah. And then to get Ron's reaction to why he said it. I think it made sense with, you know, just how his brain was working, you know. I think when you go through a moment like they just went through, sometimes someone might feel a little bit of humor, might diffuse some of the tension, but it might not be the greatest timing to use that humor. So, yeah, I couldn't. That anecdote is just crazy. It's just crazy.
Well, can you imagine if all that stuff happened now in 2019 with social media and everything? Like, not just the fight itself, but the idea that he showed up on the Today Show a couple days later and didn't want to talk about it and was trying to sell this Allure album that I couldn't even find in stores the day that it came out because the distribution situation was so bad. But his mind was, okay, can't do nothing about the past, but I can sell this record in the future.
Yeah. Well, according to Ron, Matt Lauer wasn't as honest in terms of the interview, because Matt said, no, we're just, you know, the interview is about, you know, your album and your label. So I don't know if that when that interview was technically set up. I don't know if it was set up before the incident or after. Obviously, from a journalistic perspective, I can see why, you know, the interviewer would want to press Ron on what just happened. But, yeah, you know, Von's mind was where it was at that time. And it was, you know, it was interesting to watch all that unfold.
Now, like, as a filmmaker, after that point, because this is not, you know, this is not the end of the story, obviously, but this is a big, giant, climactic moment. And I wondered, like, when you're doing a film like that, how do you determine how much time to give something like that, that is certainly a flashpoint for viewers? And then how do you, you know, balance that against some of the things that come next, like the Sacramento years, which was very important, but probably not as flashy?
So part of this, I actually have to give credit to your current employer and my former employer, in terms of building story arcs in a feature documentary style, I was trained by some of the best, you know. So, like, I was, you know, like Tom McCollum and Lydell King and, you know, Chris Bloxam and other, you know, strong feature producers who are at ESPN. I learned a lot of the ropes from those guys. So when I was trying to, you know, these story arcs that you're building, you can weigh what works, what flows, and what doesn't. So I knew what the main focus of the film was going to be, which was about Ron's condition that he was battling since basically the age of 8. So we wanted to make that the central theme, and then all these events kind of interwoven around this theme. Hopefully that makes sense.
No, it does. And I also wonder, like, I had a role in doing a 30 for 30 on Randy Moss, and we were working on it in, I want to say, the fall of 2014. And there's a domestic violence incident that Randy Moss had with the mother of his children that had been reported. And it was one of those classic cases where the charges were dropped and everything else. But, like, you don't know what to do if you're making a film. But the film was basically done. And then Ray Rice happened. And I remember if I said I made any contribution as the executive producer, I was like, hey, guys, we have to talk about this thing in here right now because it's going to look like we are whitewashing this. You have a situation in Sacramento where Artes had gone to jail for an incident involving his wife. And I wonder for you, in terms of making the film, how do you figure out how to, like, exactly how to put something like that in context? Because it's not part of the narrative. It is somewhat a part of the narrative of the story you're telling, but it's not something that you can stay on for a long time, probably because of who will and will not talk to you about it. So how do you decide when something like that happens, how are we going to deal with this in the movie?
Well, it stayed with our central theme because he went to marriage and parenting counseling as part of the court order. So it stayed within our lane that we wanted to, that we really wanted to stay on in terms of the central focus. But also the emotional reaction Ron had there up at the podium, I that moment at the podium where he's, you know, he's breathing and tearing up, I think that was the visual moment of seeing a man beginning to change for the better. So that's how we felt we could put it, you know, in that part of the film.
How did he handle discussing that? Like, in turn, getting toward the film and in the time that you had with him, how did he handle that?
Well, we didn't talk with any of his other family members. It's a little outside of his dad, just out of respect for Ron's privacy with his family. We were given permission to talk to his dad, but outside of that, so the fact that we didn't have multiple voices in it, we couldn't just have, like, one person tell one side and then not have someone else discuss the other, just from a journalistic standpoint. So that's why we rode with the press conference as the sole voice of that point in the film.
You said that his family was not made available. I was wondering about that. I guess I found that to be a little bit surprising because there is Ron's privacy, but he's as open as he is about things. I wouldn't have thought he had a problem with allowing his family to share their insights.
It wasn't Ron having a problem with it. You know, his dad was obviously great. His mom didn't feel comfortable being on camera, so that was, you know, that was an example of, like, of her of a family member not wanting to participate for a certain reason.
Got you. Gotcha. And then, of course, we then get to the Laker time for Ron. And I guess this is kind of the climax of things for him, right? Like, this is the achievement and the rise toward being an NBA champion. Because I remember when he won the championship, that was my big thing. It was like, we've lived long enough to see Ron Artest, NBA champion, with the single most joyous trip to the dais ever in the NBA Finals, where he shows up with 15 Artestuses, and everybody is just like we're here now. This has happened.
And he was, that's the moment where I feel he turns into the most important sports story of the last 20 years. They're just when he thanks his psychiatrist, who's actually his psychologist, he misspoke. Dr. Santi is actually a psychologist, but, you know, in the heat of the moment, you know, when you're on top of the world, you just won the title and you're the guy, you're the reason why they won that game, basically. Well, him and Pau Gasol, I can see why he would misspeak. But when he thanks his psychiatrist, all of a sudden there was portions of, you know, of the population, the American population, who didn't feel they had to live in the shadows as much, hearing someone, you know, at the top of their professional moment, thanking someone for helping with a condition that, you know, that we should probably start thinking about in the same way as like someone breaks a leg or a physical condition, you know? So, yeah, that's the that to me actually is the climax of the film when he thanks the psychiatrist.
Like, we saw his joy in that moment, but how did he describe it in talking to you? Like, now it's been almost 10 years.
It was so educational because he was talking about the breathing exercises that he was practicing with Dr. Santi, because he needed to master that, especially throughout the playoffs, because the playoffs are so intense. And what Ron wanted to avoid was he wanted to avoid another Rip Hamilton situation. You know, he wanted to avoid, you know, another, you know, the situation he had with Kobe when he was with the Rockets and he got thrown out. And, you know, they lose that game. But the series won 7 games. I don't think people remember. Like, Ron went toe-to-toe with Kobe for 7 games. And, as the best, basically the best player on the Rockets. So he wanted to make sure he was in a position where he knew how to control himself through these breathing exercises that he had practiced. And because he hated Paul Pierce.
That is another theme of this movie. He hates Paul Pierce.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't hate him personally. It's just, it's a competitive thing. Like, you know, you got to break it all down. Like, all right, think about where he grew up and like you had to defend, you know, you had to play this physical style of play to keep playing on these courts and, you know, in Queensbridge and around the city. So if that's how, and also the way his dad trained him, that's the only way he knows how to play. And it just took him longer. It took him a little while to learn how to control some of that stuff. He said, I'm not going to lie, I hate Paul Pierce. we almost fell out of our chairs.
Like, Ron Artest is
we're
America.
We're going down this lane. Okay.
Yeah, he's America at that moment. Like, Hey, I don't have no problem with Paul Pierce, but Paul Pierce has definitely decided that his media approach is going to involve a little bit of you're going to hate the things I say.
And if Paul wants to go down that route, that's totally his, you know, that's totally his goal. I find it entertaining. Yeah. So, but when Ron was discussing the sports psychology aspect of what he was doing leading into, you know, and that leads into him thanking Dr. Santi, that to me was so revealing because, like, I didn't know much about, I learned more about this world just talking and getting, you know, doing the story on Ron, and I still have a lot to educate myself on, you know, on this category. But that was just the intricacies of something like that, just describing the breathing exercise, I thought was invaluable.
Well, it's also interesting kind of juxtapose against what happened at the Palace, because I remember when I first saw the incident at the Palace and he was laying on the table and I was like, guys, you don't understand what's going on here. That's a man whose therapist told him to step away from a situation and go breathe. And so to hear him talk about breathing beforehand as opposed to there where he was breathing after the stuff had already kind of started is an interesting switch.
Yeah, and also, like, we heard it from Ron, but I thought it was also insanely important to hear from Donnie Walsh, who, you know, Donnie Walsh is, like, as authentic as you get. There's no lie in Donnie Walsh. So when Donnie Walsh is saying he did what he was told to do, he did what he was trained, you know, what we were working on him with, what the psychiatrist was working on him. He was applying the training. So So, you know, everyone can be like, oh, he didn't step to Ben Wallace in that situation. He didn't because he was trying to do the right thing, actually. He was going down, you know, the correct road. And then, you know, a cop hits him and, you know, that's all she wrote.
And you mentioned the idea that it became the most important story of the last 20 years when he thanked his psychologist at the press conference. When you approach doing this film, did you approach it thinking of it in that way, or is that the conclusion you came to after you had talked to Ron?
We knew the mental health would be a strong part of this. I didn't know it would be the whole thing, because my other thing with Ron is, like, he's the best defensive perimeter player I've ever seen. So, you know, and he also carried an offensive load at the same time. So when are we going to start respecting the guys in this league that expend that energy on both ends all the time? So it's like, all right, Ron has to carry a significant offensive load, but he also has to expend energy locking up the other team's, you know, best scorer. And during that time when he was at his best doing that, just think of all the players in the league at that time that he was locking up on a pretty semi-consistent basis. So, you know, you got McGrady, you got, you know, you have his battles with Pierce, you had Dwayne Wade. I mean, you know, his battles with Kobe, Dirk. I mean, there's so many Hall of Famers whose numbers went way down when they played against Ron in his two-way prime. And I wanted also that to be highlighted. But when we got like 40 minutes into the interview and he was talking about growing up in Queensbridge and the stuff that he saw in his home and the socioeconomic, you know, factors that surrounded him, we felt pretty strongly that we had to stick to the mental health angle throughout the whole film.
Was there one thing that he told you about his upbringing that when you heard it, you were just like, wait, what?
I'm a child of divorce. So when he started talking about witnessing his parents fighting, that struck a chord with me. And so when he started, going into that in full depth, I knew this was going to be important. So, yeah, when he started talking about his early years growing up with his parents in the Queensbridge apartments, and he discusses the stresses of seeing that, my childhood self connected, I felt the connection to his childhood self in that moment.
Did he talk about how seeing some of that, you know, the fighting and violence in his own home informed what ultimately happened with him in Sacramento?
No, there wasn't a connection there with him. He didn't see a connection there between the two incidents. But you know, the incident in Sacramento with the police report, the most damage that was actually physically done was to his windshield when his wife at the time threw a brick through his windshield.
So was there anything that you talked to Ron about that he was not willing to talk about? Because I think one of the striking things about him, and I've interviewed him about some of these things before, is that he doesn't seem to hold back on anything. If you ask him a question about it, he seems like he's pretty clear to give you an answer.
No, we had no, there were no, and I wouldn't, if there were things he said that he wouldn't talk about, you know, as a journalist, we wouldn't agree to it. So we wanted him to talk about anything and everything, and he was very open. There was no, he didn't give a list of demands. He didn't give a list of topics he wouldn't talk about. So, no, he was open about everything.
And now, when you talk about the importance of this story and him being willing to share this, you know, share this part of himself, and, you know, a part of the film is, you know, places that he's gone to share his story and people that have then shared it back with him. Is there any, like, in the NBA, were you able to trace, like, or any sort of, like, direct impact to what he has said and his experience and how it's changed things?
What, just in terms of the NBA, or?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, because part of the importance is he did this, but then there would be some impact, one would think.
We've seen the publicity with Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan and, you know, Tyronn Lue. So I feel he definitely created the platform for these guys to open up and talk more about a subject that was considered a stigma within athletics. I just felt like Ron never got the credit. Like, you know, he never he never got the credit for just coming out and being guileless and thanking his psychiatrist and talking about that aspect of treatment that helped him. So I'd say for outside the NBA, what we saw most is when we were going around showing this film to some of these film festivals, you usually have a Q&A afterwards, and I went up there for the Q&A, and you know, it's also with Omar, and we didn't get actually a lot of questions. We got people standing up and confessing to us their own conditions that they have had to go through, or a family member or a friend. And we knew we had done something right with this film when we were getting those kind of reactions. So I think that's in those small focus groups, that's where we saw Ron's impact at its best.
Now, for you making this film, what was the most enjoyable part of that?
The music, getting this music cleared. I love rap music. I was a DJ for 8 years. So that was outside of telling Ron's story as authentically as possible, which, you know, that's also fun in itself, but just the authenticity of being able to include the music from that era that he grew up in, I just felt it was just so important. And interviewing Noriega was the most entertaining.
Why is he the funniest person in the world without even trying?
Oh, he is television gold. I don't know why people don't go to him more, because he has so many authentic stories for, you know, both, just cross-cultural stories. He's amazing. He's a guy that doesn't hold back, but when he doesn't hold back, he throws on a gasoline of just, you know, authentic humor. I love Nori. I love that.
Well, it's also another level now that you got those teeth. Right? Because it's still the same old Nori, except he's got this big old grin in your face now when he's doing it. It's just like, whoa, there's so much going on here right now.
Oh, man. But he's so descriptive. Oh, my God. He's so descriptive. When he talked about the snow scene, when he was going out and seeing Ron, his dad, playing in the snow when he was younger, and he's falling out drinking E&J with Havoc. I was like, I told Twiz is one of the DPs on this project. I was like, whenever the next blizzard's coming to New York, we gotta get out to Queens and shoot that. Because it's like, we have to match it up to Nori's description, because also Havoc backed it up. You know, so that was just so much fun, man. Oh God, I love these Queens rappers. They're so great.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the music also, because when I first got here, I was talking to a friend of mine. She lives here. She's from New Orleans, and she was just talking about, because you walk in New York, right? That's something you don't really do in other places. You are going to be in your environment in a different way. And she was like, well, just wait, you're going to have one of those days where it's gray outside, or you're going to put on some Mobb Deep and everything is going to make sense. And sure enough, that happened, right? Like, hearing that stuff and being separate from New York was one thing, but I didn't fully grasp how native that whole sound was to this city. Like, even if you're not in Queens, but just kind of to what, especially imagine what grimy 95 New York had to be like.
Yeah, and you can, in a way, blame KRS-One for that, because he, you know, he threw down the gauntlet when he said the bridge is over. And, you know, he inspired all these, in a way, he inspired all these young MCs out of the whole borough to rise up and just, I mean, look, you and I can probably, how many artists have come out of Queens that have, in that era, that made such an impact? I mean, obviously, you know, Nas, Mobb Deep, Capone and Noriega, but also you go out to South Jamaica, the Lost Boys, you got LL, Run DMC, the 50, Ja Rule, the list of artists are just endless. And, you know, I wanted in some way to show the cultural impact that borough had at the time, and also how it impacted Ron, because Ron also wanted, the music scene impacted Ron so much that it was kind of a foreshadow for one of the problems he had in Indiana, because he was trying to set up his music label. So, that was just so much fun working on that section. That I was, when we got the music cleared and all that, I was like, I'm sitting there with Jason Sanchez and Pierre, who are our editors, and we were going to town with, you know, cutting to the music. It was so great. It was like fun. I felt like I was in a recording studio with, like, you know, having his prime. That's what it felt like.
I have wanted, actually, before I'd seen this, I had told people, like, one of these ideas that I was never going to fully carry out and never had, but, like, something like a documentary on the Queensbridge Projects, because the history of them are fascinating and such an, like, amazing collection of talent happened to come out of there. And then I watched this and I was like, no, this is kind of the Queensbridge documentary right here. Like, this kind of touches on a lot of the story right here while giving you a much better narrative. Like, way to go to take my idea, Johnny. Appreciate you.
No, you can expand upon it. I'll tell you. You could totally expand upon it, because you got to look at it. There's other things we didn't have time to expand into. So, like, you know, Tragedy Gaddafi was a guy that found a lot of these guys, you know, like, you know, Mobb Deep and helped with CNN and all that stuff. But then you also have to look at the fact that, like, if you expand it out to Queens as a whole, because Nori's technically from Left Rack, then you also have to expand to the fact that, like, it's kind of because of Nori that we know Pharrell as a household name, because Nori worked with Pharrell on Superthug. And then, you know, the Neptunes exploded in that summer, and everyone wanted to beat from the Neptunes and Pharrell. So from that, I think you have a case there if you expand it out to Queens as a whole, if that makes any sense.
Boom. There we go. There he is. Now, before we let you go, I want to talk about where Ron Artest is right now. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't he working as a coach in the D-League?
Ron is, I don't know if you want to call it coaching. I think it's more like if a player needs some help with a one-on-one type of thing, he's available. But he's also running his different businesses. So that's another thing. Like, Ron's very tech-savvy. So, you know, he's got his own digital marketing team, and he's expanded into, obviously, his own book. He's got his clothing line that he's still trying to grow. And, you know, he's also got his hands in production. So, and he still has his music label, too. So, and he's trying to develop an app. So, you know, Ron's mind goes in nine different directions at once. And I think that's, you know, he's trying to, you know, utilize that aspect of his mind in terms of growing his businesses.
Now, is there anything in going back and watching the film, you know, different things happen, you only got so much real estate to work with to get things done, anything that you look at and be like, man, I do wish we could have gotten that in there?
I wish we could have gotten Nas and Paul Pierce.
I really wish you had gotten Paul Pierce.
I know. We tried. We tried. It would have been great to have Paul in there. Nas would have been great as another, you know, just a historian, especially in that beginning aspect in terms of how the crack wars infected that entire borough. It would have been great to have his perspective on that, just because of all the stories that he had told, you know, especially on Illmatic, and it was written. I thought it would have been great to have Nas's perspective as the local historian of Ron's era there. But anyway, you can't bat 1,000. I still think Hav did a great job. I also think Fredo Starr did. No one's talking about Fredo in this. Fredo's descriptions of the crack era during that time and how it impacted family members, I thought was very eye-opening, because I was all the way in Manhattan. I didn't know on the ground how this stuff was impacting Queens, except for the stuff you hear on the news. But it was great to get that firsthand descriptions from people who grew up in that era.
All right. Last thing before you go, of all those great albums out of Queensbridge, not named Illmatic, which one is your favorite one?
Ooh, out of Queensbridge, God, that's not Illmatic. I think you got to go with the War Report.
Really? I was about to say, the answer is the infamous Mobb Deep. I feel like
No, look, I love Mobb Deep. And as a complete album, yes, definitely. You totally win that argument. But from a building yourself from out of just straight out of the underground, its most important underground album, in my, obviously, look, this is all subjective.
Oh, yeah.
But the War Report is probably the most important underground album ever made.
That's fair.
In that aspect, I feel it has that kind of separate kind of importance. But as a complete album, yeah, you totally beat me in that argument.
Total, like, almost non sequitur to all of this, but this thing just dawned on me about Mobb Deep. We've lived long enough now that we have It Was Written truthers. Have you come across these people who will try to tell you that It Was Written was better than Illmatic?
Like, why do people say that?
Like, they exist and they think it's cool, but it's wild. We don't have Hell on Earth truthers, because you can make an argument that Hell on Earth is better than the infamous, but we have no Hell on Earth truthers. That makes a lot more sense than trying to tell me It Was Written was better than Illmatic.
Look, It Was Written was a strong album, but it was more of a pop album. Like, you know, and I get it, because you know, your second album, you got more resources. But Illmatic had only has one guest appearance on there, and the one guest appearance on there, you know, with AZ is like the greatest cameo, one of the greatest cameos in the history of the genre, you know, when he's rapping on Life's a
Yes.
So it's like, look, you can go all day with music and how subjective these arguments are, but sometimes at my age, I just shake my head and I say, you can have that. Just don't talk about it in public that way.
I took you to that. Nothing like It Was Written Truther to take us to that place. Because I'm convinced all those It Was Written Truthers are 25.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's like the... Yeah, you know, millennials. What are you going to do?
All right. Now, that is Johnny Sweet. Check out Quiet Storm, the Ron Artest story. You can check it out on Showtime. Johnny is the director. My man, I thank you so much for joining us, and I thank you for the film. Shout out to my man Omar Michelle, who worked on it. You both going to get some trophies out of this, huh?
I hope, yeah. I just, before we go, I want to thank Omar so much. I want to thank Colleen Dominguez so much. She's just the most underrated sports reporter of the last 20 years, and I hope this helps in solidifying how great, you know, she still is. And Tom Friend, who's just a magnificent writer, you know, that was my squad on this, and you know, if we don't have them, this film doesn't get made.
All right, Johnny, thanks so much, man. I greatly appreciate it.
No problem, Monty, anytime.
All right, man, thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to Johnny Sweet. Also, be sure to check out the Mina Kimes Show this week with Mike Golic Jr. Remember to subscribe to The Right Time. Wherever you get your podcast, rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you're a hater. And we'll talk to you in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
Geico presents yet another voicemail from your roommate.
Hi. So, about the kitchen. Turns out, when there's a grease fire, you're not supposed to throw water on it. Who would have known, right? Anyways, the fire department is here, and it's totally cool. Give me a call back when you get a chance.
The Geico Insurance Agency could help keep your personal property protected, like if danger is your roommate's middle name. Visit geico.com to see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.